May it please the court, Arthur Krawitz for Mr. Cordero. I am joined today at council table by co-counsel Ms. Bustard and Mr. Davis.
When your name's mentioned, you stand, please. That's the Delaware tradition. Thank you.
This case requires the court to determine the proper construction of 19 Delaware Code, Section 2311. The court's review in this case is de novo. The results of the decisions below in this case at the IAB and at the Superior Court left Mr. Cordero without workers' compensation benefits. The results of these decisions are contrary to the legislature having replaced the prior statute that preceded the current version of 19 Delaware Code, Section 2311, with a new statutory scheme that separated the construction trade from all other forms of employment. The old version of the statute gave no protection to employees of an uninsured independent contractor. But the new version of the statute changed the law significantly. And that statute, the current version, protects workers whether they are employees of the subcontractors or they are what would traditionally be independent contractors. The statutory intent here appears in 19 Delaware Code Section 2311A4. And that section provides that all independent contractors governed by the subsection shall be covered under this chapter. Independent contractors shall have an option to purchase coverage to satisfy this requirement, or alternatively shall be insured by the general contractor or the subcontractor or the contracting entity for which they perform work or provide services.
Well, the issue, of course, is whether A5 provides some sort of safe harbor to contractors who obtain, as the statute sets forth, a certificate of insurance or insurance coverage. Whether even if they do, that safe harbor requires, you know, some sort of ongoing monitoring to assure that the coverage remains in effect. Is that a fair statement?
That's a fair statement.
All right. My question is, in analyzing the meaning or the impact of subsection A5, what is your side's operating premise? Is it that the statute is clear in its face, or is it that the statute is ambiguous and has to be construed under the tools of construction?
We believe that the statute is clear on its face, and in this case,
not ambiguous.
Not ambiguous.
Okay.
It's our contention that Section 2311A5 is really a record-keeping procedure. And that's designed to show the independent contractor or subcontractor is either exempt or has insurance that is actually in force or will be insured by one of the superior contracting entities on the job. If the contracting entity fails to get the required documentation, the A5 makes clear that entity is not protected by the exclusivity of remedies such that they would be, even though that they would then provide insurance, that section does make clear that they would be subject to tort liability.
Well, why isn't, under the plain language of that last sentence of A5, the converse true, that when you do get the contracting or the certificate from the contracting entity, you are not obliged to provide workers' compensation as the general?
Well, it's our contention that, first of all, if there's a, the certificate is meant to apply to insurance in force, and it just that if that section is interpreted to say that if at any point and any time a contractor happens to get a certificate of insurance that's got dates that appear to apply to the contract, that does not provide protection.
Well, the statute doesn't imply by any reasonable inference at any point in time. Doesn't it contemplate that before the work begins that the independent contractor produces a complying certificate that assures the general contractor or ultimately the owner or whoever is ultimately in control with confirmation that they do have insurance? What do you believe the statute calls for? A continued monitoring to check every day to make sure that the insurance is still in force?
Not every day, but we do think that it requires monitoring or otherwise
why?
It defeats...
What in the statute suggests that? And why would that risk be shifted in that way in any kind of economic cost-benefit analysis?
Because it's our contention that the intent of 23A4 was to shift the burden to the contracting entities, as opposed to the burden that would result on an uninsured claimant if there's not actually insurance.
Well, the burden is to require the certificate of compliance before you hire that independent contractor, or if you nevertheless hire that independent contractor who doesn't provide you with the certificate that complies, then of course you do assume the business risk of providing workers' comp coverage, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
But once you get the certificate, what is there in the statute that says there's a continuing obligation to monitor it to make sure that the independent contractor hasn't produced either a falsified document or one that he cancels on a later date for his own economic reasons?
Well, if that's not done, then there's not insurance that's actually in force under 23-1185.
Well, you mentioned in your very opening comment that this would deprive the worker of workers' compensation coverage. But is there no other remedy?
There could be tort liability.
There's a tort remedy, isn't there?
Yes.
I mean, if there's a trade-off, if you have workers' comp coverage, then you can't bring a suit in tort against your employer. But if your employer, by some artifice, you know, as a subcontractor, deprives you of workers' comp coverage, then he's subject to a tort suit, correct?
That's correct.
And if the facts, as suggested by the Superior Court opinion, may be true, which is that Rodriguez customarily would get a complying certificate and then cancel it on a regular basis, and that the general contractor either knew or should have known that, wouldn't there be an equitable remedy available in Chancery for fraud? And couldn't the ultimate damage for that be the equivalent of workers' comp coverage that's lost as a result of the inequitable fraud?
That is a potential result here, although it's our contention in this case that Mr. Cordero should be able to explore that opinion. The Superior Court did point that out, that there's a good faith element here, but that was not considered by the IAB and has not been considered at any point to date. And
the main contractor, Gulfstream, could also be subject, apart from an equity suit, to a Superior Court suit for damages for failure to exercise good faith and assuring that the employer subcontractor had workers' comp coverage for the employees.
That's a potential cause of action.
Well, let's go back to the ambiguity. As I understand the Superior Court's opinion, it looked at the statute, said you need a valid certificate that covers the applicable time period, and a valid certificate was produced. Where the problem developed is when the insurance was subsequently canceled. So under the statute, what was the obligation that wasn't met?
Well, one of the things that's a problem here is that we don't know when this certificate was produced as it relates to a date of contract. And one of the problems in this case is that the Industrial Accident Board made a decision based on a stipulation. The statute talks about a date of contract.
I understand that's an argument, and I understand that. So let's assume there was a date, and let's assume that this certificate encompassed the applicable dates. We'll call it a hypothetical. Under those facts, we have a fixed contract period, and you have a certificate that covers the fixed contract period, and later, the policy's canceled. Under this, where do we look to the statute to see what wasn't done?
Well, the statute doesn't spell that out, but what the court found that there's an implied...
It doesn't address that situation, does it?
It does not.
And your claiming that, yet you're claiming that under the plain language or plain meaning of the statute, that the consequence has to be that the contractor, one layer above the employer subcontractor, is now liable to provide workers' comp coverage, even though the statute doesn't explicitly say that.
Well, we say that, not that subsection. We say it's our contention that 19 Del Code Section A4 mandates that there be insurance.
Because the carve-out that's provided by A5 doesn't apply.
Correct. That's our position.
What in the statute, permits a court to infer that in those circumstances the carve-out or the safe harbor does not apply?
We don't interpret that as a safe harbor. We say that 2311A4 actually mandates that coverage be required.
Well, all right, let's pursue that. A4 mandates the coverage. The 2007 amendment didn't change A4, did it? It was A5 that was enacted in 07? Is that right?
Well, I think that both. There were two changes to the statute, but this whole concept
of... Let me say differently. A4 provides the basis for liability. All the contractors in the chain are basically subject to a statutory duty to apply to get workers' comp coverage for all of the employees that are affected, that are hired by anybody in the chain. What does A5 add?
It's our contention that A5 is a method for a contracting entity to ensure or help ensure that there is coverage. So that, to make the determination that...
Well, what difference does it make? If I'm a contractor higher up in the chain than the employer subcontractor, and I'm on the hook, so to speak, because of the statutory operation of A4, what difference does it make to me, or how does it benefit me to insist on getting a certificate of coverage?
Well, it would benefit that contracting entity to get a valid, to have actual insurance in force so that that contracting entity is not responsible for the workers' comp payments.
But it is responsible. It's just that somebody else's insurance company, I guess, would be first in line.
That's
the implication, but that's not... The statute doesn't really address any of that, does it?
It does not. The statute does not give any priority as to which entity would be responsible. The assumption would be that it would be the next entity up the line.
You agree that if the drafters of the statute had wanted to cover this situation, they could have covered it explicitly in A5, but they did not?
They did not, and certainly could have been covered more clearly.
Did the Superior Court also start with the premise that the statute at issue here is unambiguous?
I believe the Superior Court said the statute was unambiguous. And it simply the contractors had met their obligations under the statute.
Your claim is that there's no ambiguity, and you're saying the Superior Court also started with that premise?
Yes. If this court finds that there is ambiguity, then the statute must be read in a manner that is going to promote its purposes, which in this case is to make sure that there are not uninsured workers on construction.
Well, is anybody arguing that there is ambiguity?
We are not. No. As it applies to this case, the General Assembly required that Delaware Siding determine that Rodriguez Contracting was exempt, determine that it had insurance for its workers, or remain responsible for insuring the workers of Rodriguez Contracting.
Well, in that regard, and doesn't the record reflect that the certificate and that the siding company got also included the siding company's phone number and something to the effect, if the insurance was canceled, we're going to call you at this number, although I realize it said something about notify you in writing. But to the extent you're making an argument that they had an ongoing obligation to monitor, they at least got a certificate that said, if anything changes, call us. Didn't they?
They did, but the insurance company left a, did not accept the responsibility to do that timely.
I think what we're trying to ascertain is why the siding company didn't do something that was required by the statute. And the Superior Court said getting a certificate was enough. Now we're beyond that, because you're arguing ongoing monitoring, and the siding company got a certificate that said if this insurance is canceled, call us. What else could the siding company have done?
Well, one thing would be to check the history of this company. Another thing could have been to have the siding company's additional insured so that it got direct notice if the policy was canceled.
I take it you would then say it would also be incumbent upon the company to check the economic standing of the insurer to make sure they actually could pay if a demand was made against them, or perhaps the holding company that owns them as well. Isn't the purpose of A5 to allocate risk and to take into consideration the cost to the system of the allocation of risk? And isn't that sentence in A5 that says, in effect, you're relieved of the responsibility to insure the workers of the independent contractor if the independent contractor produces a certificate of insurance that complies with the purpose of the statute? Isn't that a judgment made by the General Assembly about where the burdens lie?
Well, if that's interpreted as a safe harbor, then yes. But still...
Well, how would you write that sentence out of A5? How does reading A5 with A4 and the overall purpose of workers' comp make any sense under your argument unless you simply read out the compliance certificate shift or allocation of the burden of risk?
Well, again, the statute does require that the insurance be enforced at the time of contracting. So if this is going to be read as a safe harbor, that insurance has to be enforced at the time of contracting. And that showing was not made at any time in this case. So even if it's a safe harbor, if the record should be interpreted to be closed as to that issue, there is no showing of a date of contract.
Well, was it ever raised as an issue? You mentioned the stipulation. You mean to say the stipulation didn't cover that?
The stipulation did not cover that. There is
then how
no...
are we expected to deal with it here if it wasn't an issue below?
Well, it was an issue. It was raised. That's not how the board made its decision.
Ms. Kravitz, has your client brought a tort action against Rodriguez?
There was a tort action that is no longer pending.
Is Rodriguez still in business?
We actually were not able to find.
And I take it your client hasn't brought a separate tort action against Delaware Siding or Gulfstream for acting in good faith or acting in bad faith in reliance on the certificate of insurance?
There has not been a separate suit on that issue.
And there's been no exploration of the Superior Court's, I'll presume to call it, suggestion that if there were facts that showed that the general contractor knew that this was a pattern of conduct on the part of the independent contractor, namely to get a certificate of insurance, to appear to have complied, but then on a regular basis on other jobs canceled it during a time it was supposed to be in effect. If the general contractor knew that, wouldn't there be an equitable claim for fraud?
There would be an equitable claim. We also think that there's a potential claim here if the case is remanded back to the Industrial Accident Board to make those findings.
But that's also an issue that wasn't raised before them in the first instance. That just came out of whole cloth from Superior Court, correct?
That based on the Superior Court's interpretation of the statute, yes.
Okay.
Thank you. I'm into my rebuttal time.
Okay. Thank
further
you.
Questions.
Mr. Chief Justice, I have no other questions for the attorney, but with your permission, I'd like to direct the Capitol Police officer to put that magazine down.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. I'm Robert Richter on behalf of Delaware Siding. And it is our position, Delaware Siding's position, that Delaware Siding complied with all the requirements of Section 2311A5. A certificate of insurance was issued on February 26, 2008, was faxed by A to Z Insurance Company to my client, Delaware Siding, on February 28, 2008. That declaration of insurance showed coverage was in force from January 9, 2008 through January 9, 2009. It named Delaware Siding as a certificate holder on the policy. It is our position that because Delaware Siding had that certificate, it complied with all of the requirements of 19 Delaware Code, Section 2311A5.
And as a,
what does that mean to be named as a certificate holder as opposed to being named as an additional insured?
What it means is, it's my understanding that they have, that the, what it is, it's proof to Delaware Siding that Rodriguez Contracting had insurance from Liberty Mutual. That's what it means. It means that they hold the certificate of insurance, and they can rely upon that certificate so that they've complied with the statute. That's what it means.
And therefore what? That they are relieved from the responsibility or the duty imposed by subsection A4?
By subsection A5, because subsection A5
is a safe harbor that, if it's complied with, relieves them of whatever duty is imposed or whatever obligation is imposed by subsection A4.
That is correct, Justice Jacobs.
All right. And in addition, I gather your position is that once the certificate is delivered and is possessed by, you know, the contractor or subcontractor, that there is no further obligation to, that is no further due diligence obligation to ascertain whether or not, you know, that certificate is accurate or remains accurate, correct?
That is our position, because there's nothing in the statute which requires Delaware Siding to do any further investigation. Had the legislature intended, wanted Delaware Siding or another employer in its position.
All right. Is it your side's position that the statute is unambiguous?
Yes, sir.
So is it fair to say that nobody in this case is taking the position that the statute is ambiguous?
That is my understanding.
Okay.
And
what's your position on the new or should have known about Rodriguez's pattern of conduct in obtaining and supplying certificates of insurance and then canceling them while the work is in progress, which is suggested at least by the Superior Court opinion?
Chief Justice, that is suggested by the Superior Court decision, that if they had known or should have known that there might be liability here. There is absolutely no evidence in the record that Delaware Siding knew of Rodriguez's conduct. If the attorney for Mr. Cordero, had they wanted to pursue that issue, they should have done it at the Industrial Action Board level. The Industrial Action Board transcript shows that all the parties agreed to a stipulation of facts. In fact, the attorney for Mr. Cordero stated in the Industrial Action Board transcript that it really was an evidentiary hearing because we'd resolved all the issues. We'd have stipulation of facts. The only issue was whether or not the employers in this case were in compliance with Delaware, with 19 Delaware Code, Section 2311.5.
So there was no factual dispute about the date that the certificate took effect?
No. There was no dispute. There was a stipulation of facts entered to, and it mentions contract, and it was assumed by all the parties that what it was, these are not large companies. Delaware Siding is not a large company. This is not Shell Brothers. This is not Ernest De Sabatino. This is not Toll Brothers. This is a small company. The way this works, in by and large, in the small businesses, is that the small business, in this case Delaware Siding, contacts Griffin Rodriguez by phone and says, we need someone to perform roofing work and we need a certificate of insurance. At that time, Griffin Rodriguez, Rodriguez Company, calls his broker, in this case it was A to Z Insurance, and says, fax a certificate of insurance to Delaware Siding. And that is exactly what happened here. There was an oral contract, and there was never any argument made at the Industrial Action Board level that there was no contract. That was not brought up before the Industrial Action Board. We introduced stipulation of facts, which is in the record, which says that Delaware Siding contracted with Rodriguez, and the main contractor had contracted with Delaware Siding. So there was no dispute as to whether or not there was a contract. It's clear from the facts that the certificate of insurance was prepared on February 26th. It was faxed to Delaware Siding February 28th. It showed coverage from January of 2008 to January 2009. The accident occurred on July 31st, 2008, within the policy period, and therefore Delaware Siding complied with all the requirements of the statute. And that is our position. There's no evidence of fraud, and there was no evidence of that Delaware Siding knew. And to suggest that Delaware Siding should monitor insurance coverage, how are they supposed to do that? The legislature didn't state anywhere in the statute that they needed to do it, and if so, are they supposed to check weekly?
I take it there's nothing in the policies themselves when you provide this certificate that would require notice of a cancellation.
The certificate of insurance, which was issued to Delaware Siding, says on it that we may let you know if we're able to, that the policy is canceled, but we have no liability, we have no requirement to do so. And there is no legal requirement in the statute that the certificate holder be notified.
Well, if there were a legislative fix, which the Superior Court said would be necessary, is that one potential one to require notification so that the general contractor either gets its own insurance or causes some remedial action?
That is up to the legislature to do what the legislature sees fit. I would remind the court respectfully that the court may not assume that an omission was the result of an oversight. And I think that is something that our legislature would need to consider.
Mr. Richter, is it accurate that the Superior Court judge added this gloss sua sponte that the party that holds the certificate of insurance can rely on it but has to rely in good faith?
I believe that was dicta on the part of the Superior Court.
Well, was it argued by any side?
No.
All right, but it's now, well, we now have that. What should happen now? That is, if the trial judge saw fit to gloss the statute in that way, then wasn't it incumbent on the trial judge to give the plaintiff an opportunity to show, if it could, there was no good faith reliance?
It is our position that the plaintiff gave up the right to explore that avenue when the plaintiff entered into a stipulation of facts and decided not to call any fact witnesses. The plaintiff had the opportunity.
Yeah, but isn't the answer to that the plaintiff had no way of knowing that that would be one of the rules of the road until the opinion came down?
That this is true.
So how can there be a waiver of a right that didn't exist at the time but came into existence as part of the decision on the merits?
Well, the statute does not require, the statute is it's our position the statute is plain on its face. It requires that you obtain a certificate I think it was dicta on the part of the Superior Court decision to state that if there was evidence of bad faith.
Well, let me put the question more sharply, if I might. You're arguing that this court should affirm the decision of the trial court.
That's correct.
But the trial court's good faith gloss or bad faith gloss in its own merits opinion suggests at least the possibility or the argument that the case should be remanded to give the plaintiff an opportunity to develop a position as to good faith.
Justice Jacobs, I believe there was a footnote in the decision written by the Superior Court stating there was no evidence in the record that Delaware Siding had any notice or any evidence of any bad faith on behalf of Rodriguez Contracting. And I believe it was the intention of the Superior Court that it would only that would apply in another case if there had been evidence that there had been knowledge by Delaware Siding or a situ or a company like it.
Doesn't that suggest that Mr. Cordero was catch 22'd? There was no argument made. That is, he had no reason to suspect that good faith would be an issue until the judge's decision comes down. Then the judge says, well, too bad, you didn't put in any evidence of bad faith.
Well, Mr. Cordero is no different situation than an individual, and let's say a pedestrian who's injured in a motor vehicle accident when he's hit by the driver of a motor vehicle who had insurance in order to get his motor vehicle registered in the state of Delaware, which is required, and then the insurance is canceled. And the driver of that vehicle goes out and injures the pedestrian, and because the driver of that vehicle has no insurance, the pedestrian's right of recovery is he needs to sue the driver of the vehicle personally without insurance. And if that pedestrian did not own his own motor vehicle or have an insurance policy, he would not be entitled to underinsured motorist protection. And the situation is very much analogous to what the situation is with Mr. Rodriguez. Mr. Cordero has the right to sue Rodriguez Contracting because they had no insurance. That's his right to do that. And collect whatever he can collect. He also has the right to sue the other contractors on the site for negligence if there was any negligence. So it's our position that Mr. Cordero has remedies and that my client complied with the statute. If my client had not complied with the statute, then they'd be liable. But they did exactly what they were told to do. They went out, they got a certificate of insurance, they held on to the certificate of insurance. That is what they required to do, and to require them to do something else without any instruction is just, should not be.
Has the appellant requested that this court do anything other than reverse on the basis of the actual holding of Superior Court, which is an argument that the Superior Court misinterpreted the clear and unambiguous statute, and that your client should be obligated under the statute to provide workers' comp because the certificate of compliance turned out to be ineffective? Is there any other argument before us other than that?
No. Just in summation, I would just like to tell you that it is our position that Delaware Siding complied with the statute as it is written. And if the legislature had wanted to put more information as to what someone like Delaware Siding should do, they should have done so. And thank you.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court, John Ellis for Gulfstream Development Corporation in this case. I'm here before you today in a slightly different position legally and factually from Delaware Siding, and I'd like to address arguments relevant to the liability of Gulfstream that would be separate from Delaware Siding. as it seems like sometimes Delaware Siding and Gulfstream are somewhat lumped together in this case, both in arguments from claimant's counsel and also in the holding.
Do you disagree with any of the statutory interpretation arguments that Mr. Richter has made?
As far as whether the statute's ambiguous?
Any of the statutory interpretation arguments?
No, I do not. I believe the statute is clear on its face. It says to obtain and retain a certificate of insurance in force at the date of the contract and retain that document for a period of 3 years. So I believe it's clear on its face. In relation to Gulfstream directly, the issue is obviously whether Gulfstream is subject to liability whatsoever under 2311A5, and we would urge no. Unless the court points me in a different direction, I would address the following sub-issues, which is whether Gulfstream is a contracting entity in relation to Rodriguez, whether Gulfstream complied with the language of these statutes, whether the claimant's supposed monitoring system is reasonable, and whether there's a basis for remand. Those seems to be the issues presented today and relevant to Gulfstream.
Is it correct that your position is that since Delaware Siding was the subcontractor in the immediately above Rodriguez in the chain, that if there is any statutory liability under subsection A4, it resides with Delaware Siding?
I believe factually that's correct, and I would go beyond that
and not Gulfstream.
Right, and I would say that factually that's correct, and legally to go beyond that, as a matter of law, it's not possible to reach Gulfstream in this case. Statute uses the term contracting entity, which is in 2311A2 and 3, and only the contracting entity has liability under the safe harbor provisions. The definition of contracting entity is one that obtains work or services in exchange for remuneration from an independent contractor or a subcontractor. Therefore, by those very definitions, there must be an implied or express contract. Here we have absolutely no privity of contract between Gulfstream and Rodriguez whatsoever. No contract, no formal relationship, no knowledge whatsoever. My client didn't even know there was an injury until a year and a half later, once litigation began. As Gulfstream only contracted with Delaware Siding, they could only potentially under the statute be liable for the Delaware Siding employees if they didn't obtain the certificate like they were supposed to from them, not Rodriguez's. The second question is whether Gulfstream complied with the language of the statute, and our position is definitely yes. I understand the difficult factual circumstances of this case, but urge that what we need to do is apply the law to the language of the law to the facts of this case. The language says for contracting entities to obtain a certificate of insurance in force and retain that document for 3 years. The dictionary definition, which I presented in my briefs, means obtain and retain means possess and keep in possession. And as the court is aware, every word is chosen by the General Assembly for a reason. As the court noted in the Dorshaw-Pasquale versus Nanico case that was decided in January, those words are often bargained for by interested constituent groups. So we would urge that the words simply be given their ordinary meaning, and that Gulfstream's actions to obtain and retain the certificate achieves the goal of ensuring coverage is there for certain classes of injured workers. The next portion I'd like to address is this proposed insurance monitoring system that has been raised by the claimant, moving beyond the statutory language just as to whether it is reasonable or not. The claimant argues that in his brief and a little bit today that monitoring would be easy and free if you just simply looked on the Department of Labor website listing of insurance. So it's there. Why not just simply judicially require or contractors to look on that site, even if it's not required by the very language of the statutes? We would say that that proposal is definitely best left to the General Assembly for several reasons. First, the Department of Labor website showing coverage is not actually run by the state or the Department of Labor. It's run by a separate entity called the Delaware Compensation Rating Bureau. That is a nonprofit private corporation which is based in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. its primary purpose, there's an enabling statute for the Department of Insurance to provide recommendations for yearly insurance rates. It is my understanding that they provide this information on the Delaware Department of Labor's website simply as a favor.
Sorry, is this in the record?
Well, it's in response to the...
Is it in the record what you're telling us about the reliability, the source of the information about ongoing insurance coverage and its reliability?
It is in the record in the sense that the claimant stated that this system would be easy and reliable.
No. Are there facts in the record that support what you're saying, or support what the plaintiff is saying?
I don't think that there are any facts, and that's the problem. Is there's this informal system in which this the DCRB maintains this website, and there's nothing to cite to. And so there's an assumption. Well, it's the website is there, it's reliable, but there's no information to support that, and that's the problem. And what we don't know, and
none of that was put before the Superior Court or addressed by the Superior Court. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's correct. This argument really only came up since the Superior Court level, and I would just ask the court, you know, how reliable is relying upon this Department of Labor website? We don't know the rate of error, especially when the DCRB is relying upon carriers to send them this information. I know personally I've had two cases where it turned out that the information on the website turned out to be inaccurate.
You do take Justice Jacobs' point, don't you? If there are no facts in the record to support the contention you're currently making, you're wasting our time.
Okay, understood, Your Honor. Turning back to the statutory language, I think what's important to take away is what you don't see in the language of the statute is as important as what you do see. You don't see language requiring a monitoring system, and why? Because it's never was intended by the General Assembly. The intent was a balance.
It's the same argument that your co-counsel made.
Right? Understood.
You're just giving us additional reasons why he's right.
Correct. I would just move on then finally as to the basis for remand that was suggested. We don't think that there is a basis.
Where was that suggestion made?
It was suggested and discussed both in both prior arguments.
I take responsibility for that. I may have suggested it.
No. I mean, is it an argument made by the appellants in their briefs?
That's correct. And today in the oral argument. And it's our position, obviously, that there should not be a remand in this case. It was, in fact, the claimant's idea to present the evidence in the form of a stipulation of facts. We had our witnesses ready to go, two witnesses the day before, and they proposed and drafted the stipulation of facts with some tweaking that we all agreed to. As far as I know, there's never been a remand where a party strategically chose to present evidence, lost, and then asked essentially for a do-over. Due process allows the parties the opportunity to present evidence. They affirmatively chose not to, represented by counsel, and therefore I don't believe there should be a remand in this case. And it was brought up previously, well, there's no notice to the appellant as to this bad faith exception raised by Judge Carpenter. And I would say that in other cases, bad faith has been interpreted into the statute by the Supreme Court. Not long ago, in reference to the 5-year statute of limitations, when that would kick in, the period for counting it, from either date of mailing or date of receipt. And the Supreme Court said it's by date of mailing, as long as there's no bad faith on the actions of the person mailing.
Right, so you're saying that Mr. Cordero's counsel should have anticipated that the court would, on its own, develop a good faith or a bad faith gloss on the statute, and since it counsel didn't anticipate it, they're out of luck.
Essentially, yeah, they had their strategy to propose the stipulation.
Anything further?
Nothing further. Thank you.
just to briefly touch on a couple points. This is essentially, at the IAB, was a decision on motions to dismiss by each employer. The fact that the stipulation in this case that was agreed to by all counsel did not consider all facts necessary for proper application of the statutory provision does not limit any of the parties' rights on review de novo. If the IAB's decision...
Help us understand that. Can we review what's in the record? If the record are stipulated facts, how do we get beyond the stipulated facts?
Well, if we just look at the stipulated facts, then it's our contention that the employers did not meet their burden here because there was no date of contract established in the stipulation. We're not arguing that there was no contract. What we're saying is there's no date of contract. So in order for the employers to take advantage of A5, if it is interpreted as a safe harbor, there has to be a date of contract. And that just wasn't done. It wasn't contemplated by any of the counsel in the case. So there's no way for any reviewing court to properly apply the statute if we don't have that date of contract. So there can't be...
their argument is the date of contract wasn't really an issue, that this was an oral agreement and everybody knew there was a contract and everyone knew that the certificate covered the applicable time. The real dilemma is what happens when the certificate's canceled?
But that's... We respectfully disagree that is the issue. The date of contract is important, and it was missed in this case. And there's no way to measure because we don't know that at any time that Delaware Siding may have inquired about insurance on this particular project, we don't know if Mr. Rodriguez did regular work for Delaware Siding or it was sporadic. So we don't know at all that this date of contract may have taken place one day before the injury occurred. And if that's the case, there was no insurance in force and there was no valid certificate. It had lapsed. So if there's a safe harbor provision that's going to be applied by the courts, then it has to be based on the date of contract or there's no valid way.
Well, maybe I just don't understand the record. I thought that the injury occurred several months after the certificate of insurance.
Long after, and it was...
So you're telling me you don't know that the contract didn't start the day before the injury. That's what confuses me. They got a certificate of insurance 6 months before they needed it, you're suggesting?
Well, they could have. We don't know. We don't have any information as to what Mr. Rodriguez did in his business and what his relationship was with Delaware Siding.
But is it unfair to conclude that before the IAB, no one thought that was important? Because otherwise, it would have been a critical ingredient of any factual stipulation, wouldn't it have been? If your contention is correct?
I agree that it should have been in there, and it wasn't. And that without having that, there's not a proper way to apply.
Well, and you made a reference to de novo review. Where is the de novo review in this process?
This is an issue of law. The application of the statute is an issue of law. And that the date of contract is required for proper application of provision, Section A5 in the statute. So essentially, the employers want it both ways in this case. They want to say nothing can be considered except what's in the stipulation, and yet want to read in a date of contract that doesn't exist. Finally, it should also be noted that the Industrial Accident Board, in its decision, did note that if Delaware Siding knew the certification was no longer valid, a different result might apply in the case. And again, that came up in the IAB's decision. And finally, the last thing is we did ask for a remand in this case, which was argument 4 of our brief. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.